I'm Tony Sakic.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
This week, Facebook made some really interesting news. They've made the decision to offer their service, Facebook.com, available over the anonymous Tor network. The Tor network, obviously, is the onion router. It's sort of a network of proxies bouncing back and forth so that you can actually detect what the origin of the outbound request was. I found this really interesting that Facebook, you know, obviously the biggest social network out there today, has made the decision to offer their services over this network, which historically has been associated with hackers, and a lot of people think it has a bunch of illegal activity going over it. You know, why would you want to protect your privacy? What do you make of this, Tony?
I think it's weird that it's Facebook, first and foremost, with the clear violations, I would say, of privacy that they've had in the past. It's funny to me and seems odd that they would do that. So I think it's a decent idea. I mean, any service that you can get where you can increase your percent, I like to say anonymity percentage, because to me, you know, as we have we're going to talk about in a minute, you're never truly, truly anonymous yet. But I think that it's interesting that it's Facebook. That's what shocks me the most, is I would expect this from a different company first, not the one that, you know, is very openly tracking people that download their Messenger app on their smartphones and other things, and how data hogs they are, what kind of data hogs they are with everything. Try exporting your contacts for like any other service. Good luck with that. So it just shocks me more than anything else. But hey, you know, I guess it's a good first step. It doesn't really, you know, good for them.
Yeah, I think this actually, it somewhat legitimizes Tor. Not that anyone approves of Facebook or their invasive privacy efforts, where they literally are building shadow profiles for even non-users of Facebook. I wonder if they're using this as a sort of a way to offset that perception as well. Nobody really trusts Facebook. I mean, if everybody's thinking about their privacy, of course, they're really hesitant to post anything or even private message people on Facebook, because they know everything that they do, anything related to Facebook. I mean, every website on the internet that has the like button installed on it, you're being tracked on Facebook servers. And they're measuring what you read. They're measuring what you look at, how much time you spend on those sites, you know, what you do, whether you like it or not. They're tracking all this stuff. So I wonder if this is sort of a way to offset that. I don't think it's going to work. I think that anyone who's trying to actually use Tor to maintain their privacy, Facebook is not one of the services that they would be using, obviously, just because of that very nature. But as far as the validation is concerned, Tor is it's a good solution to a problem, but there's a lot of skepticism about it, right? A lot of companies are really hesitant to like interact. In fact, a lot of services even explicitly block traffic from Tor because they don't want to be exposed to what they perceive as the negative, the things that are happening negatively when you're trying to protect your own privacy.
Yeah, and I think the privacy issue is something where, and it's social networking in general, where, you know, one of my biggest uses of the internet is social networking, and I do want to create, or I do want, you know, a mesh solution where I can not necessarily need a centralized, you know, database to do my networking and chatting with friends and family. But the fact of the matter is, my friends and family are not about to use a more technical solution. They like Facebook for chat, and that's what they're using. And, yeah, you know, it's really, you know, I like to use ADM a little bit as a client, but it's also something where, you know, they're not necessarily going to use, they all use Facebook anyways. Twitter's too complicated for some of my family and friends. So, you know, there really isn't an option. And, you know, if you really want to stay in contact or do event invites, Facebook does do that really well. I'm a firm believer that the absolute best security is what's between you as a person and the interface that you're putting in. So if you're typing, the best security is knowing what to type and what not to type, and what to say and what not to say, if that's really concerning you. Because then if you put it on the internet in any shape or form, or even on a computer that's connected to the internet, even if you don't know it's connected to the internet and you plug in a USB drive that you know someone has bugged, which has happened and there's proof of that, you don't know. So I think that, it's something where I begrudgingly give in, but I don't want to. There needs to be that solution that comes out. I think it eventually will. It's just not going to happen anytime real soon, I don't think.
Yeah, I think what you're getting at is something that a lot of people forget, is that the internet in itself, the reason it is so powerful is that it is the universal censor-proof publishing platform, right?
It's not censor-proof.
It's not censor-proof because it's not completely finished, right?
Okay.
The internet in its ultimate design is censor-proof. The internet detects censorship and routes around it as if it were damage, right? Mm-hmm. That is what the internet does. So when you choose, when you have the discretion to not publish something on the internet, right, then that's how you're truly going to protect yourself. You're going to use other mediums, or you're going to use proper, strong encryption. Right, and that's why the government in the 90s made it illegal with their ITAR regulation, and still continues to try to make it difficult to use encryption, because it removes power from them. And I think that's really the big indicator here of why this is such a big deal, that Facebook is sort of validating this. But speaking of some sort of these other ideas and privacy on the internet, another service exposed over Tor, Silk Road 2, which was created, I think, about a year, 366 days ago, launched 366
about.
Days ago. And they just this morning have announced, the FBI has, with a joint effort of the European Union and the Crime Enforcement Network, has seized Silk Road 2 and a couple of other of these markets that are available over Tor, but no other services. I for one, am kind of upset about this, because look, it's November 6th today. Yesterday was the 5th of November. You know, remember the 5th of November. Everybody just got done watching V for Vendetta, and, you know, there's a statement about censorship and privacy and this overblown government that's going to step in. And here you go to the Silk Road website, and you see the logo of the FBI and the European Enforcement Network, and, you know, and it's kind of ballsy to me. I'm like, are you kidding me? Are the governments really going to poke the sleeping bears of these people who have not only survived the taking down of a free trade platform, the Silk Road, from the first one, and Ross Ulbricht obviously is, you know, on charges for this, and but they came back and created Silk Road 2, and now they're going to attack it again.
Well, I think it's pretty easy what's going to happen next, which is Silk Road 3. It's you know, look what happened with music. You can't stop it. Someone else is going to create the same service. And the thing I think that's important to think about with Silk Road is how much safer it made the streets, really. It made violence go down. To me, it was almost like a plus when it comes to just the safety and crime in general. And, you know, but a lot of people don't think that way, of course. And I don't think you're going to change their mind. But what I think is going to happen is Silk Road 3, and they're not going to be able to stop it. And then, you know, so whoever gets busted with that was Silk Road 4. And then eventually they're going to realize that they're just spinning their wheels and, you know, maybe think about options that are realistic and devoting their resources into something more fruitful. The other thing when it comes to, you know, Silk Road, the seizure in general and like that, is the community that was built around Silk Road 2, from everything I've heard, you know, it was very much, they had higher customer satisfaction than like Comcast, but you actually had happy customers.
Well,
and
like, they got all of their money stolen, right, from their hot wallet, and they endeavored to pay everyone back. Like,
yeah,
all of the money that they were making from the exchanges, they're putting that right back into customers' wallets because they screwed up, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard – I mean, look at the banks, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah,
you trust the banks with your money, and, you know, they lose your money. You know, what are they coming to answer for it, right? Okay, so
mm-hmm.
You got the FDIC securing deposits up to $100,000, no more, right? What happens when you lose more than that? And a lot of people lost more than that on Silk Road. And the Silk Road, too, has successfully paid back, or up recently paid back, 100% of customer deposits on their own dime, on their own effort. If that doesn't represent an upstanding business, I don't know what does.
Absolutely, and it absolutely, you know, represents that. But what it also is, what's happening is, you know, you're getting that clash of law and, you know, the internet, and it's going to happen, and it's going to continue to grow, and it's going to become a bigger problem. You're going to see that, you know, this isn't going to stop. They're not going to stop going after these sites. I don't think it's a ballsy move on their behalf at all, because the power is clearly in their favor right now. I think that with education, things like us talking about this and saying, hey, you know, you don't need to even think about using this service to care why we talk about it. Well, you should care because there's ways to communicate and your privacy is changing every day. And it's an inherent right. It's a human right. It's to privacy. And you have the right to take steps to ensure that privacy. And there's nothing wrong with that. So when you see things like what's happening aggressively by the FBI with encryption, you know, most people don't think about that. But it's to me a more of a defining issue than pretty much anything that was debated for the elections the other day. You know, and it's an issue that people need to care more about because this is really defining what will become our new economy, what will become, you know, our new culture, and the way business is conducted and the way communication is conducted. And it's not just happening. It is happening now, but it's going to continue to grow. And, you know, you can keep putting up roadblocks and things like that, but you're not going to stop it.
Yeah.
And as soon as you kind of admit that, maybe we can work on fixing other issues.
What was really interesting, you made two points. Number one, you talked a little bit about the elections. We just came out of, I think, two or three states, the midterm, whatever that word is. And two or three states have gone on and legalized marijuana. I know Alaska is one of them. Still no response from the federal U.S. government about this. Still not too much movement in the international markets about this. But that bleeds into sort of the second question. It's like a lot of these states, members of the Union, right? They're recognizing that when you criminalize something, specifically drugs in this case, the only people who will be doing business with it are the criminals.
Yes.
And these are the violent actors. These are the people who carry guns because they're carrying high values of things because they have no other mechanism to do it, right? Mm-hmm. They're the people who are looking to steal, are looking to murder to gain for profit, right? Would you rather have those people on the streets where the things that they're trafficking are extremely high value? Or would you rather decriminalize it such that the price gets forced down and there becomes less incentive to involve violence in these things? And attacking the Silk Road, I'm going to go ahead and tell you, if you eliminate these free trade places, yes, of course drugs flow through them, of course. But so too do other very legal things, right? Like, if I want to do free trade with someone, the best way to do that right now is through an online marketplace where I simply use the post system, I use Bitcoin, and I don't have to touch a bank. I don't have to worry about someone, you know, taking my money, even if I'm sending something legitimate. Mm-hmm. But specifically in the context of, you know, these questionably criminal aspects, whether it's drugs or something else, taking these things down actively increases the amount of violence on the streets because they no longer have a marketplace where they can safely transact. I think it would make much more sense if we had a sane and rational government, which clearly we do not, for them to support an endeavor like this, right? You know, create a sort of a competitive marketplace for these services so if you're going to transact, like, at least let it be in a safe mechanism. Like, you shouldn't have to meet someone face to face if I'm buying a book from someone. Similarly, I shouldn't have to meet someone face to face if I'm buying drugs, right? I can get mail order pharmaceuticals, right? If it's by prescription, I can get that. I can also get mail order pharmaceuticals that are currently not legal under the federal framework or the international frameworks. So I don't think that there's a wide enough reaching thought process going into these policies.
I also think that the people that are in charge of both legislation and enforcing legislation are both older and out of touch to this world. And when they kind of they don't understand that, you know, obviously there's a group of people that understand the drug war has failed. But do they also understand that things like this are solutions to problems like violence that comes with black markets? And I think it's so beyond. It's just so beyond something they can grasp.
Right.
You're talking to people that probably don't use email.
Right.
You know, that tells you what kind of decision makers are in this country. If they're just that unaware or clueless, purposefully or not, of what this is, like, look at our Supreme Court and how little they know.
I mean, we got to be careful about, you know, approaching ageism and treating older, quite wise individuals who may have insight. Rather than saying that they're just not in the know, we got to help them. Like, what is it that we can do to help educate, you know, our senators? They're there to represent us. The House of Representatives is there to represent us. The senators are there to make their own decisions, right? what can we do to help educate the people who are we are choosing to put in those places, or the corporations are paying to put in those positions, right? Once you're sufficiently educated, these decisions become much clearer, right? And you at least are able to approach them with rational thought. Money speaks, obviously, but information speaks much more strongly than money.
Yeah, and I think that it is a complex thing, and it is a complex thing to explain or teach, because where do you start trying to explain a decentralized marketplace to someone who has never used a computer, or self-admittedly or not? And you're right that I'm not speaking as an ageist here, but I am speaking as someone who look at the average age of someone that is representing us, and then look at their decision-making and their comments on things like net neutrality and who they're taking money from. And then you know why, you know, terms like the internet, or what was it, the internet is a series of tubes comes out. You know, when you see things that are just completely just out to lunch. And there's an anger, but I think it's a lot from younger people. And I think that we're also at this thing where there's this cross-section of the Tea Party and of Occupy Wall Street that are finally converging, and because there are some things that they both have in common with each other, which is this, you know, we're angry, we're fed up by government, and what are we going to do? And then they have different reasons, but maybe the reasons aren't all that different. And, you know, the anger that was happening out of the exit polls represents that, you know, and it bothers me that instead of just, you know, instead of saying, okay, I'm angry, I'm going to vote for a third party candidate, they still vote for one of the two and then complain about it, where it's like, okay, there's things you can do and there's things you can't do. And if you're going to be that angry at your government, you need to change it, or you need to not be involved. And that's really how I feel about that. But there are also things, I think, on the free market and the privatized side, where that dollar that's invested in the free market, which we've spoken on in the past, to me means more than who's in power, because we're at a point now where technology is overcoming a lot of these obstacles. So, you know, there's things that they can stop and they can. And, you know, I think the free market's really going to explain and help a lot of these issues. Hi, Tony Sakic and Eric Martindale here with Zach McVoy from Voylay Capital, who is our guest today. Hey, Zach, how's it going?
Doing well, guys.
Awesome. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I had the chance to meet you in Detroit at the Detroit Bitcoin Expo, which was one of the biggest events they've had in Detroit regarding Bitcoin. It's a very industrial city, or a very manufacturing-based city. And I was really fascinated to see someone there that has provided venture capital to a lot of companies. So I wanted to give you a chance to give a little bit of your background and just talk about, you know, what companies you've invested in and what they do.
Yes. So we are a Michigan-based fund made up of four partners, and we're investing the capital of each partner. And we focus really on seed and early Series A companies. And with us being relatively new, there is quite a bit of a boom in terms of tech startups here in Detroit. And it got us real interested in it. But one of the things we wanted to do as a fund is see how we could separate ourselves from the crowd here locally. And one of the things that brought us to was Bitcoin. And we did a lot of research and a lot of study, not only on Bitcoin, the application, but the protocol it was built on. We got super excited and really wanted to focus our a lot of effort towards those endeavors. And doing research here in the state of Michigan, I found that there wasn't a whole lot of people focusing on in this space. So what it did is took me out to California, to New York, and places where Bitcoin is a heck of a lot more popular, and also there's more companies focused on it. And so we the first thing that really hit home with us was the remittance aspect of it, and led us to our investment in 37 Coins, a plug-and-play accelerator company. And the second one led us to BlockCypher, which is a Boost accelerator company, and they're focused on APIs for the blockchain. And then that led us actually to getting away a little bit from the Bitcoin application, and it led us to smart contracts. And so we invested in a company called Secure Asset Exchange, and they're doing smart contracts on the NXT exchange. And then we're actually finishing up a fourth investment that I can't discuss here that is involved with native Bitcoin application. And yeah, we got really excited about it. And you know, the reason for that whole Detroit Bitcoin Expo is that trying to bring awareness to people involved in the tech community here in Michigan. And you know, with the rebuilding of the city and the things going on here, we think that we could separate ourselves from a few different cities by focusing on Bitcoin and blockchain technology. And that's something that I've tried to put more and more effort towards and try to get people that have some big check writing capabilities focused on here in Michigan. And so that's currently what we have going on right now.
That's excellent, Zach. How far is this sort of crypto Bitcoin investment idea from your core thesis? It sounds like you have a couple partners. What was your core thesis before you guys saw this Bitcoin thing sort of exploding? And then how far of a deviation is this for you guys?
So with us operating with the four partners and not having any LPs, we figured that we didn't really need a strict for sure thesis, right? Because we weren't going out and when we first got into this, a lot of VC groups that I was talking to would ask, well, what's your guys' main focus, blah, blah, blah. And we didn't have one. What we had is we knew we wanted to be strictly tech-based. We didn't want to get into manufacturing because that's what we currently do on the outside of the fund. And so that's all we knew. We wanted tech-based and very early. And so we did a few investments here in Michigan that we're excited about and some other parts of the country. But then as my knowledge in the Bitcoin space and the blockchain space grew, it really led us to focusing more on that space. And truly one of the big proponents of I guess our investment mentality is network effects. And Bitcoin, essentially, and blockchain and the decentralized aspect of it really epitomizes what network effects is. And so it led us to it. We're in the process of closing this fund and looking to start a second one that will be all focused on Bitcoin application and mesh networking. So essentially the two big aspects of decentralization.
Oh, that's fantastic to hear that you guys are interested in mesh networking. Some of the most exciting projects that we've seen come out over the past, you know, probably the past year, have been in the aspect of the underlying infrastructure to transmit information, the mesh networking aspect, peer-to-peer networking, all these things. As you've sort of, you know, exposed yourself and your partners to this new ecosystem, this we call it crypto finance is a word that we like to use. How is crypto finance different? You talked a little bit about the network effect. How is crypto finance different from perhaps maybe a traditional technology investment?
Yeah, you know, see, the something big that we see here in Michigan that I don't know if we rely on as much is there's a lot of patents going on. You know, a technology that maybe is just a little bit better than the competition, right? Or I hate to generalize, but some of the startups here in Michigan tend to be a little bit behind what you see out in San Francisco and some of the other places, which is unfortunate, but it just it's nature of the beast currently that we're looking to change. And so what they're doing is just technology that is a little bit different. And so with the in the crypto space, I think it's leading to a big ginormous difference in terms of what's going on right now. And so the decentralization part of it is what really excites us, and as well as that the transfer of assets and the way of not needing a centralized entity to make transactions trustworthy. I think that's the big difference in this space, and I think that's what is exciting to a lot of investors. It's just that lack of trust that you need to transact something.
Yeah, that's exactly what excites a lot of us as, you know, people who are working in the Bitcoin space or for other decentralized tech companies is this ability for individuals to sort of manage their own, whether it be financial assets or securities, equity in a company. That it really is really exciting to us. But the other thing that's kind of questioned, and I think maybe you as an investor will have some good insight into, well, if there's no more centralized entities or fewer of them, certainly, what happens to the opportunities for revenue, whether that be, you know, software as a service or professional services, whatever that may be? What do you think that the new mechanism for delivering value is going to be, or return for investors?
Yeah, that's actually a great point and a great subject. I think once you have a new technology that people technically open source, you have a race to essentially centralize it, right? And I think a great example is obviously the internet in the early 90s. No one really, the average Joe didn't really know how to connect to the internet. So what happened is you needed web browsers, right? And there was a race to see who could dominate that space and be the controlling entity that allowed people to access the World Wide Web and essentially the internet. I think you have the same race going on here in the Bitcoin space, the crypto space. You have the likes of Coinbase and blockchain.io that are trying to be the wallets and essentially the everything to everybody. And so even though you have the concept of decentralization, I think you really you have people that are trying to be the controlling aspect on that and try to generate revenue that way. And in ways it's bad, in other ways it's good, because the majority of people don't know how to produce their own wallet or create their own wallet, and they don't know how to access the blockchain. They don't have access and knowledge to be able to utilize some of these technologies. So in order for the masses to adopt it, you need to have these entities that emerge that allow people to access this new technology. But at the same time, for these entities to operate, they need to be essentially generate some revenue or be profitable. So I think even though you have this decentralization, for people to access the technology, you're going to need some revenue generating companies to allow people to operate through.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking forward, you know, you can talk about, you know, mesh networks and things that you're excited for your current investments. What do you think maybe in 2 or 3 years are going to be the number one topics of discussion? What are going to be the biggest things that are happening in crypto finance?
You know, I wish I knew exactly, right? I could have that crystal ball. One of the things, though, that hit home with me has actually been the last couple of days is with voting. Right, they had those glitches. I want to say it was either in Virginia, where we're using some electronic voting systems, and there were some glitches where they didn't know if they were double entering essentially the vote, right? Or they didn't know exactly who received the vote. And I started thinking about it, and blockchains can essentially solve that, right? If everybody that signed up or went to vote got access to a coin. You can essentially use that to vote for your candidate, and the candidate with the most coins, essentially would win. That would be all the votes. And you could see each and every one of those coins where, and essentially who voted, right? So that whole aspect of not knowing or not being able to know, the voting accuracy, I think could be solved with blockchains. And I think that can be done with a lot of applications that have yet to be built. But the other thing that I think is really big, that has a big time potential is obviously micropayments online, right? Utilized for either content creators or even for emails. So essentially, instead of, say you have a blog, right? A free blog, and you generate revenue through ads. What about if the people, the readers, you would get a paragraph or a few sentences, or even a subject. And if you wanted to read it, it cost you 2, 3, 4 cents, right? So if you had a favorite blog, you wanted to load $10, $20, $30, whatever it was, that blogger or company essentially could start generate revenue by users using micropayments. I think personally, that is probably the biggest next application for Bitcoin is micropayments. And same thing with email. Everybody who receives spam all the time, I get spam all the time, and unsubscribe to certain things, maybe Expedia or companies like that. It would be great if you needed a penny or 2 pennies to send an email. Because the likes of normal business or normal people with email, $10, $15 would suit you for a couple of years. But the entities that send out hundreds of thousands or millions of emails a year, I mean, you can't get spammed. It would just cost too much for them to do that. So I think micropayments for The internet right now, or the World Wide Web, I think is the next thing to be super, super popular in terms of revenue generation for websites.
Yeah, I actually agree, and that's something that Shooter Jennings spoke on too with music, which I think is still a little further away. And you know, I wanted to also get your opinion on a little different topic. Yesterday, I read a fascinating article in Bitcoin Magazine, and it was with Vinay Gupta, who is a cypherpunk cat who's been around forever. You know, one of those people that I really look up to because, you know, they really, sometimes I think the people I talk to foresaw this early. There are people that foresaw this really early, and they're the ones that really put the pieces in place to make it work. And it was basically saying that, you know, Bitcoin is teaching realism to libertarians, which I thought was a very nice statement. And I highly recommend that article because really what it said was, and the premise I came away from reading the end was about people that got rich in Bitcoin and basically reinvesting in it and to build, you know, to build this platform, to build it and keep, and that's what you're doing, and that's what we really need. And I think so far, obviously, with the amount of VC funds that have came in this year, it's really worked well. But there is, you know, I think for the community itself, there is going to be something where, and I think it's going to be happening soon, where you're going to see, you know, I don't know how exactly to put this, but you're going to see the VC explode even more. And you're going to see that really that word disruptive and disruption is massively overused by companies that don't actually disrupt anything. They just maybe have a cost-cutting measure, whereas, mm-hmm. you know, Bitcoin really is disruptive in every sense of the word. And, you know, the funding is really crucial because, you know, you really need that at this point of the game to hire the best and brightest. And when I had a chance to speak at the Detroit Bitcoin Expo, it really was interesting to me the kinds of folks that came through. And one of the most fascinating gentlemen I spoke with, I don't want to give his name out, was a very high he had a very high position at General Motors. And I thought it was absolutely fascinating that this guy from a very traditional industry he had two treasures on him and he knew his stuff. And really from what I've seen from GM, from, you know, the outside living in Detroit in the past, it was a very manufacturing-centric company. But, yeah, there are people that are really thinking and, you know, doing things differently, and that needs to be utilized in order, I think, to compete with, you know, the Teslas of the world for the big three. And, there, you know, the funding is really what's going to change a lot of local impressions, I think, because once you see the amount of money that's coming into these companies, I think that's going to wake up Michigan, and they're going to kind of see, okay, our eggs have been in this one basket for too long, and this is a little bit too Michigan-centric, because, you know, that's my home state, and I love it still, although I love Atlanta, too. It is a little different, and the funding is really, really crucial. And, you know, we want to make sure that, you know, the companies that have the funding that deserve funding are getting it. And I think so far so good. You know, it seems like a lot of the VC is coming in properly with the amount of hype that ChangeTip has been getting. I love that. I think the tipping system is awesome, and I think that's a great way to bring people in. But I really do think, and not congratulate you, but thank you, you know, for being a part of this that's coming out and putting money, you know, putting money down and saying, hey, we believe in this technology, we believe this is going to work. And really wanted to ask you, what would you say to someone who maybe is someone from Michigan or anything in the Midwest that's really centered on a traditional background of manufacturing or of whatever their industry may be? What would you say to them to why they should invest? Why? You know, like almost like an elevator speech. Why?
Yeah, you know, so I think that's one of the issues that we have here in Michigan. You know, there's VCs that have some money now. It's in some funds that have a lot of money, and it's not as much as obviously some other parts of the country. But there's investors here that are looking to spend money, but the companies that are here are very good companies, but they're not the newer type of technology like Bitcoin and the blockchain is. And so, because those companies aren't essentially located here, a lot of the investors here in Michigan don't focus on those areas, right? They have LPs that are from Michigan. They want to help continue the growth of Michigan, which is great. So when companies that maybe come out of University of Michigan or you know, even here in Detroit that are Bitcoin centric, it's hard for them to find money here. So that's why they have to go out west, or they have to go to New York or Texas, is to get money from the VCs, from investors to help their company survive and grow. And so one of the things that the Detroit Bitcoiners or the Michigan Bitcoiner group and I are really trying to do is trying to educate as much investors as possible, trying to kind of create a group of us that say, okay, here's X amount of money that we are going to put specifically towards Bitcoin groups or blockchain groups that we want them to come in Michigan, operate here, and we're going to fund them. And one of the great things about Michigan compared to some of the other cities that are big in VC funding is cost of living lower. The cost of operations are lower. And there's a lot of benefits of the universities around here. I mean, we have tons of universities and talent that the state could keep. You know, and we have Dan Gilbert, who's one of the biggest promoters of the tech world here in Detroit. He's got a VC firm. He's got an accelerator. He's got a private equity group. I think, and he's built his empire essentially on a ton of transaction companies that you would think Bitcoin fits right along with the likes of Quicken Loans and One Reverse Mortgage and things like that. And so even though when you think of Michigan and you think of Detroit as manufacturing and as automotive, I think in a lot of ways too, we're big into transactions and Bitcoin and blockchain would fit nicely into the city and into the state. And I really hope and really plan on pushing the movement to try to get some of the people that have check writing capabilities to open their checkbooks to the likes of those companies that can help build that new technology.
So what are you thinking about some of the potential risks? So obviously you're interested in obtaining a return, obviously changing the world for the better, which will generate further return. What are some of the risks, some of the major hurdles that are between where we are today and this sort of post-blockchain era?
So it's obviously government in terms of the quote-unquote currency aspect of Bitcoin or the application. And so one of I still don't know or have an idea if we are going to transact daily in the first world in Bitcoin, right? I don't know if I'm going to walk over and buy a cup of coffee using Bitcoin. Now, I think that's potential in some of the third world underdeveloped countries that they don't have an existing banking system. So I think in terms of the risk, I think that is a risk. I think if you strictly invest it into the currency aspect, that you got to keep a close eye on what's going on with policy, government policy, and to see exactly where that goes. But as far as the technology aspect and the different type of forms of transactions you can do on the blockchain, I think that technology is here to stay. And so I think one of the risks, though, is getting a little too far ahead, right? So you have decentralized autonomous companies, which I think is a phenomenal idea. Eventually, I will look to invest in that area. I think that might be a little early right now. Not saying that it can't gain some traction, but to really gain mass adoption, I think that is a little far ahead. So I think some people operate in the space, you know, you see all this money getting put towards Bitcoin and they want to be the first movers in certain entities. And so they start looking ahead of the blockchain technology and they start investing in things that are sound crazy to the average person. I think that is technically a risk. So I think really what happens the next year or so is really going to tell where this technology is going. And I think that people right now that are jumping ahead because of the applications that could exist, I think that's a little bit risky and that we're trying to avoid that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's an absolutely fantastic point. So let's say I'm an entrepreneur in the Bitcoin space. What are you providing me as advice as I move forward to make sure I maintain that focus? What do you recommend that Bitcoin entrepreneurs out there do?
In terms of the technology they're developing or the company they're developing?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, in terms of not getting too far ahead of themselves, in terms of just making sure that they can build a successful business.
You know, so it's obviously keeping track of the market and what certain companies are doing. And one of the things that I believe needs to happen is we need a Netscape, essentially, for Bitcoin, right? We need something that's easily can be adopted by the masses that can have easy access, right? And I don't know, or I haven't really seen it yet, companies that are essentially have done that, right? I think it's a little fragmented. You have wallets all over the place. You know, even even trying to buy a Bitcoin through Coinbase, company like that, I still think is a little difficult. You know, you wait 5 days, blah, blah, blah. And I know there's people trying to solve that and things of that nature. I also think the liquidity of the Bitcoin is also technically a problem, especially with the volatility. So I really think and what I'm looking for and looking to invest in and suggesting is making it easier for people to utilize and to understand. And even though it's a little bit of radical thought, not everybody, no one really understands the banking system truly, right? I mean, some people do, obviously, but the average person that uses a bank doesn't really truly know how it works. And so I don't think we need that, but people know that they can walk into a bank and deposit a check, right? They know how to use their bank. And I think what's happened in the Bitcoin space is for there to be companies that are focused on the ease of use to bring this technology to the masses. And I think that's what I think a lot of investors are looking for is the company that can really bring it to the masses. Maybe it already exists in the likes of some of the bigger Bitcoin companies that are out there. But that's what I'm looking for.
I think that Circle and Trucoin are steps in the right direction.
Yeah,
you know, I think that you know you're going to get the two worlds. You're going to get the very core Bitcoin world that really doesn't want any cooperation, and then you're going to get the world of you know investors and people starting their companies that realize they need to toe the line and you know, not alienate the Bitcoin user base, but really make this easier for everyone to be a part of. And, this is something where I don't want to speak on behalf of anyone other than myself, but I think the Bitcoin Foundation could be doing a lot more or some entity like that as an industry-wide effort to really, you know, push forward, you know, things that are just good for Bitcoin, not necessarily centered on one specific use of it just in general. And this could be in decentralized technologies, you know, in general. There really doesn't need to be a specific point, but it does need to be a little less, I don't know what the word would be, but it seems like the Bitcoin Foundation spins their wheels a lot and causes more controversy than actually solves problems. I think that's because of a few small bad actors, but again, one rotten apple. So it really does, you know, there needs to be that next step. I would actually agree completely on that and say that I'm waiting for something to come along that makes it easier for people, and that's not a solution. I don't necessarily think one company will come up with immediately or will come up with, you know, with all the intricacies that are involved. Whereas with Netscape, it really was a little different. I think it was a different positioning, a different time, and there was different communication methods too. So, you know, using the internet to hype up Bitcoin and talk about it is going to make Bitcoin grow faster than the internet, because really what were they using to promote the internet, or they are internet users? It was really magazines, newspapers, and television to some degree. You know, and other than that, if you weren't a part of the community, you know, I remember the first time I heard about the internet was on the PBS show Ghostwriter. You know, that was a ridiculous show, but yeah, it was like really the first time I heard about it as a kid. I had no idea. I thought it was the coolest thing ever, and it really fascinated me. And you know, and that's where we're going to have quicker growth than the internet had. But you know, it's going to be important to not outpace ourselves and not, you know, grow too fast. But in the same token, get new users aboard and get them to understand why this is, you know, a positive.
Yeah, but at the same, I totally agree. At the same time, though, I think it's a little bit of a detriment as well, right? Because if you mention, especially here in Michigan, people that aren't familiar with Bitcoin very well, and you talk about it with them, you know, they think, oh, what about the Silk Road, or what about Mt. Gox? And what they first react to is the negativity, right? The volatility of Bitcoin, some of the big swings. And I think that they don't really understand the true value of it. Also, you see some of these exchanges that are losing money, blah, blah, blah. They trust their bank, right? Because if something happened, their bank can always get their money back, certain things like that. And so I at the same time, it will help with the integration and the knowledge of it. But some of the negative press could also hurt it based on how quickly we can get information. And so that's why, every time I see a bad apple on the internet, it makes me cringe, because it's almost like a roadblock to the mass adoption.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, you're going to see when I say this, no one can see my air quotes, the legitimate uses of Bitcoin really, you know, trump the others, the illegitimate, again, air quotes. I'm not necessarily saying they're legitimate or illegitimate because they're all just uses. It's a tool. You know, they're really, you can use a knife to cut your steak. You can use it to murder someone. It's all how you use it. But you're going to see that trump that, and you're going to see more of a positive spin in the near future. And it's already starting, I think, just like from the presence and announcements at Money 2020 this week. You can kind of tell that that's happening and that shift is coming. But we actually are about to wrap it up. We wanted to let you plug anything that you wanted to plug, any of your companies, your Twitter, whatever you wanted to speak on.
So it's Voile Capital, a Detroit-based VC firm. And anybody that's doing anything interesting in terms of the Bitcoin blockchain or even the mesh network space, please contact us. The website is Voile, so just VoileCapital.com. You can find my email there and get a hold of us, and we're open to all and any ideas in that space.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Zach, and we will check you later.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Zach.
Take care. Bye.